And welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate overlooked, ignored, derided, and just plain hated contributions to pop culture. Novels, movies, music, comic books, video games, improv comedy, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. This is episode 14, and you can find the show notes at ump.fm. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is a writer who's covered the tech industry, pop culture criticism, online retail, comics, and even the marriage lessons we can learn from MTV. She also currently writes a thrice-weekly digest newsletter called So What, Who Cares? About what's happening and why you should care. But she's probably best known to podcast listeners as a regular panellist on The Incomparable, a host of the Flash Flashcast, and co-host of Phil and Lisa Ruin the Movies. She is, of course, Ms. Lisa Schmeiser. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It is such a pleasure to be here.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe this is a case where, well, it's quite similar to episode two, actually, where Lee Alexander talked about the Twilight books, because as I understand it, the work you've chosen is actually rather popular and has even won awards, but there is a whole big segment of people and fandom in this case, who dismiss it, assuming it's not for them, without really knowing what it's actually about. I hope that's a fair summary. So tell us what you've chosen and then give us some context around its release, its reception upon release, why it's generally maligned and why you disagree.
All right. In some particular order, I am here today to talk about Anne McCaffrey's World of Pern, The Dragon Riders of Pern. The books were released from 1968 through the mid-aughties, where she began co-writing them with her son. Anne McCaffrey died a few years ago. When she first began releasing the books, she did win some awards, specifically for the novels or short stories or novellas centered around her female protagonists. The reason I'm coming on the show to defend them as being unjustly maligned is in the 1980s, there was a bit of a critical backlash against some of the bedrock conceits of her world building. And what I've noticed, although she has an ardent online fan community, what I have noticed in younger fans is a sort of a puzzlement as to why these books are so loved. And I wanted to just talk about that a little bit today, you know, why they may have connected with people of a certain age, why they may actually be an artifact of their time, why it's worth revisiting them for what they are, and how my relationship to those books has changed from when I first discovered them as a 10-year-old to how I look at them a few decades removed at this point, and how that's changed over time. They were comfort reading for me for years and years and years, and the last time I picked them up because I wanted something immersive and comforting and predictable, my reaction to them was so completely different than it used to be. The disconnect has been poking around for like a year and a half, you know, where I tried to unpack it and figure out why. And when you invited me on the show, I thought, well, this might be an opportunity to explore that and to talk about what these books meant and why they're important or why they were important to me, why I enjoyed them, why someone else might enjoy them, and why that enjoyment may be highly contingent upon where you are in your life when you read them.
It sounds that way, yeah. I hadn't realized quite how old these books were. I mean, I knew that they were old school SF, of course.
Yes.
But for some reason, I associated them with the 70s rather than the 60s.
I think part of that might be because she really hit her stride on them and shaped them as a trilogy in the 70s. Dragonflight, which is the first one, actually started off life as, I believe, a short story or a novella called We're Search, where she wrote what is basically the first third of Dragonflight, which came out in 1968. And then her next two sequels were 1971, 1978. And while she was writing those, she also launched the second, I would say, iconic Pern trilogy, which is the Harper Hall trilogy. That's a YA or young adult series. And that focuses on a young woman who wants to be a musician, is thwarted by her family, runs away, and then effectively ends up adopting a passel of mini dragons. And it's a classic adolescent tale. It was actually my first exposure to the series as a 10-year-old. And it's an excellent entree. But those were also written through the 1970s. And then in the 1980s, that's where I tend to associate them because that's where I read them. A whole lot of, who was the author that you and I were just talking about?
Michael Whelan.
Michael Whelan. Yeah. That's when he took over the cover art and it shifts to this very 1980s aesthetic where it's almost photorealistic, very sharply painted. but what actually hooked me as a 10-year-old were the Fred Marcellino covers on the young adult books. They're beautiful and dreamy. And for somebody who was growing up in a fairly small military town in Virginia in the 1980s, they had a certain exoticism that made me pick up the book. And then when I began reading, you know, I was sucked in. And at the time, it was very revolutionary. Now, however, with a lot of science fiction and fantasy being such a female-focused genre with girl protagonists who are empowered and having journeys on their own, you know, what seemed very different in the 1980s is now pretty much the norm.
I think that's definitely, that's definitely something to take into account, isn't it? That sort of context,
mm-hmm.
because this is what I mean about them being, if they're, you know, written in the 60s, that's really impressive to be that kind of, that progressive with your protagonists. And I can understand how they were, you know, would have at the time been perceived as quite revolutionary in that sense.
Yes. What was really interesting, if you read the evolution, if you read the books over the course of her career, because she did write about this world from 1968 to effectively 2008 or later, and that's what, 40 years. And what I find interesting is what's shifted and changed in her perception and her world building versus what has stayed the same. And in the earlier books, the idea of the heroines being independent is still, they're societal anomalies, and a lot of the book is about how they handle that and how they engineer change. And by the end of the book, it's a much more modern take on gender relations. So you could almost argue that the books follow the arc of societal change as well. I mean, they don't precede it like really revolutionary or imaginary or predictive science fiction and fantasy do, but they do follow it. So as you're reading over time, you can kind of see where the author shifts her viewpoints and where she becomes a little bit more progressive, or where she acknowledges that previous elements of world building were a problem. For example, I remember, and I guess, let me just tell how I found these books.
Yeah, please do. Yeah.
I was 10 years old and I was over at my homework partner's house. We were in, we had class together and we were supposed to be doing a science project, and my homework partner had a microscope. And so we were going to look at various types of cells in the microscope and make pictures. And Becky had a pile of library books next to the microscope. And I have been a compulsive reader since I was 4 or 5 years old. If there's something in the room, I'll pick it up and I'll read it. You know, cereal boxes, product pamphlets. If there's not a book around, it's any. If there's not a book around, I just start reading.
I read cereal boxes too. You're not alone.
Yes, and as a child, it was even worse. My parents had to break me of the habit of zooming over to people's bookcases the first time we went to a new house.
I still do that.
Yeah, no, it's an unconscious habit. And one of my favorite things about making new friends as an adult is actually getting a chance to look at their bookcases and then ask them, you know, why did you keep this book? Which one of you read it? What did you connect with? And seeing what people have curated collections and what people are largely scattershot readers. It's fascinating. It's a great way to get to know somebody. But to reel this back 30 years ago, Becky had her pile of library books, and she did have she had Dragon Song. And again, it had the Fred Marcellino cover on it. Marcellino is, and I may be mispronouncing this, it's Marcellino. And he did the art for the book in the 70s. He and Elizabeth Malczynski were the two big ones. But the Marcellino art is lovely and dreamy. The dragons have these enormous gossamer wings. They're almost Chinese with the facial features and the whiskers. And they have these lovely languid paws, and the dragons flying against this hazy sky with crepuscular light in the distance. And it spoke of travel in faraway places, and I was intrigued, and I picked it up and began flipping through it. And poor Becky is patiently setting up slides and doing our project as I'm flipping through. And the book hit all of my 10-year-old buttons, because it's about a girl who is desperate to express herself, through music. And again, as a reader and a writer, even at that age, and she's not understood by her family. So she runs away and she shifts for herself in a very hostile terrain, and she does well. And again, you're a dreamy child, and most of the person thrust into the wild narratives that I had run across in my school library had been about boys.
Yeah.
And this was the first one where there was a girl, and the course of the story is very simple. She gets into trouble. She gets rescued by somebody who rides a dragon. And by the end of the book, she's been packed off to the planet's one conservatory where she can legitimately study music because she's legitimately talented, and her new friends, the miniature dragons, go with her. But the whole idea that she makes the necessary and painful separation from her family, and she finds out who she is independent of them, and she gets validated in her gifts. These hit all of the building blocks of pre-adolescence and adolescence. And so I fell in love with the series and read it. And then a year later, when I found out there were the adult books, I checked them out from the library and dove into those too. And from there through middle school, every time a new book came out, I was putting in an order at our local bookstore so I could get a paperback copy. And they were the books of my adolescence. And I would take them on trips. I read them multiple times. I could probably still recite passages if you asked me. And it wasn't until high school when I was reading a collection of very short stories about dinosaurs and dragons where somebody pointed out how preposterous and wish-fulfilling some of the aspects of the Pernes universe were that I began to think, wait a minute, there are things here that are troubling. And then, I would revisit the books or read the later ones as an adult and think, huh, that doesn't sit right. Or, that's interesting. And then once I got online in college and found out how other people receive the books and how they process interviews and things like that, it's always a shock to find out that something you loved wholly uncritically as a child is riddled with errors. And then when you have to go through and critically examine them, you have to re-examine your own relationship to them. What do you keep and what do you throw out? And so for a few years, I was like, something I read as a child. And then when I was in my 20s and 30s, if I was going through a particularly strenuous or difficult or challenging time, I'd find myself actually reaching for these books again and reading through just because I could slip back into that immersive experience. And McCaffrey really did excel at world building. And I was able to actually read them with an adult distance, an adult critical eye, but still some measure of childish enjoyment.
Uh-huh.
I think I'm defending my childhood experience more than I'm actually defending the books, because there are things about the books that I feel are actually, and this is an overused word, but it applies here. They are really problematic and they should be addressed and acknowledged. But at the same time, again, she excels in world building. And when you take a look at the context of when she started writing them, it is still a pretty significant accomplishment. She invented a planet and its society and its economy out of whole cloth. And what I do enjoy now as an adult about the older books is watching how she tries to backfill in a lot of the developments. Because in 1968, a quasi-medieval society that had originally been founded by space bears but had devolved into a feudal system with dragons, maybe that flew, but by the 1990s, people are going, well, wait a minute, if they had science to begin with, why didn't they do X, Y, Z?
Right. How come they lost all this knowledge and stuff? Yeah.
Yeah. And as an adult, that really bugs me about the books, to be honest with you. Just as my least favorite book is the one where she tells the origin story of the colonists landing on the planet, which is besieged by deadly parasites that the dragons fight. And, when she tells the origin story, it's a wholly egalitarian society. Women are battle veterans and scientists and administrators, and they're in positions of authority. But for a tremendous number of the books, their roles are greatly diminished. And I always found myself wondering why this author, who also happens to be a woman, was so willing to write women in subordinate positions, or so willing to build a world where the acceptable default was, as soon as possible, women lose their full legal and social rights.
But correct me if I'm wrong, isn't the lead protagonist of both the main trilogy and the Dragon Song, the YA trilogy, they're both female, aren't they?
Yes, and that's what makes it even more interesting, is in both books you have women who are fighting against the strictures of their society and setting, and they're effectively second wave feminists in that they insist that they can do a job, they do it, and they blaze a trail for the women who come behind them.
So I think that's quite admirable, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I can't be the only girl who read those books and sort of internalized the message that it was okay to go against societal grain if you were doing it for a greater good or if you were doing it to honor the talents that you had. As an adult, I do find it slightly troubling that the books are basically written with the message that special women are allowed to do special things while other women can go ahead and keep on cleaning house and taking care of children and acting as support to the really interesting and productive members of society.
That is something I wanted to talk about. It's an element that does... Now, I confess that I have not read these books, but I know of them, obviously. You know, you can't be an SF fan and not know of them. And also my partner Marcia is, you know, like you, she read them first as a young girl, mm-hmm. loves them. She has a nearly full collection of the old paperbacks in our lounge. You know, I kind of have never needed to read them because she will happily tell me all about them at great length. But one element that does concern me a little are the hints of predestination and not quite divine right, but that same sort of feeling that, yeah, there is an elite class of people that you are, you know, if you're born into it, you're special. Because, correct me if I'm wrong, the ability to bond with a dragon in these, because they have a telepathic link with the dragons, don't they? And that ability to bond is genetic.
It is. And they never come out and say it explicitly, but in the origin story type books that backfill in, I believe it's called Dragon's Dawn, and they mention in some of the prefaces, people who are innately empathic. So people I can't believe these words are going to come out of my mouth. People who genetically express an ability for telepathy,
right,
are the ones who are able to telepathically bond with the dragons. And there are a lot of strong suggestions that it's a strong it's clearly tied to a genetic component. I'm not sure, to be honest, I'm not sure Anne McCaffrey actually thought this one all the way through. Because if that were the case, you would actually have families of people dominating the dragon riding culture and industry.
Absolutely, yes. But the chosen one trope and, you know, those sorts of that sort of idea.
Oh, it's everywhere in those books.
It spans storytelling throughout history. And I think certainly back then in science fiction and fantasy, it wasn't, because they were both such young genres, it wasn't as overused.
That is one of my criticisms of the books as an adult, is the chosen one and the discovery story is endemic to the Pern books, where there's always somebody who didn't ever dream they'd be worthy of a dragon, and all of a sudden they're chosen and their life changes. And I mean, it's the equivalent of a family throwing up a genius musician after 10 generations of tone deafness. And it happens with incredible regularity. And if you were to defend the books, you could probably say, well, genetic randomness has to happen to make sure that dragon riders themselves don't become inbred.
Fair point.
I would certainly nod and say, yes, you're right. But what I find fascinating, because I know almost nothing about this author. I'm actually a firm believer in the Raymond Chandler aphorism, if you liked the book, don't meet the author. And so I know almost nothing about her, but I am kind of fascinated with how over the course of McCaffrey's books, there is essentially a class of people who are your chosen ones, both because they've come up through the ranks of because they're well-connected or well-bred, or because they're just so magnificently determined and selfless and ambitious simultaneously that people can't help but want them to excel. So she has difficulty writing for the kind of character who's caught up in circumstances greater than they are. Her characters are almost always people who boldly grab their destiny by the throat and shake into submission. And, you know, again, when you're a child, that's really appealing because it appeals to, it touches on a child's innate egocentrism. And it also gives you this narrative of power where you firmly believe this is something you can do. As an adult, you're like, I'm not so sure it works that way.
No, you're right. As a child, that's what you want. You know, every child believes that they are, you know, some kind of special person and the chosen one, if you like, mm-hmm. themselves.
Exactly.
I have found that as I grow older, I have less and less patience for that as a storytelling device. It just occurred to me, I wonder if George Lucas is a fan.
Yes, it's a question whether or not you've grown up or just grown older.
But yeah, the way that they bond with the dragons, for the benefit of listeners who may not know the books, as I understand it, is that when the dragons hatch,
Yes.
Certain humans who have this telepathic ability, there's a process called impression.
Yes.
Where they sort of, you know, not necessarily the first human they see, but they have to see them when they're young, mm-hmm. and they bond telepathically. Which again, slightly problematic to me.
Yes.
Kind of.
Well, there's a lot of wish fulfillment there where.
Well, I first came across the idea of something like this actually in the ElfQuest comics.
Yes, yes. Oh, I love those. And I read those around the same age too.
Right. Well, and there's something in there called recognition where two characters sort of recognize one another.
When eyes meet eyes is the phrase that they use, and they reveal their real name to each other because they're biologically simpatico with recognition. Only elves that are recognized can have a baby, and that's how they keep the species going. Yeah.
Exactly. And so therefore they marry and, you know, they become life partners because they're recognized. This strikes me as, I mean, obviously that came after the Dragon Rider books, but they strike me as similar sort of concepts. And I don't know, I kind of, again, as a youngster, I didn't really have a problem with it. But as I've grown older, I'm like, yeah, I'm not so sure about that.
Well, I think the reason it appeals to children and to teenagers is the impression confirms that, one, you are incredibly special. You're so special. You have a dragon and few other people do. Because the books are so clearly set up in a way where dragon riders are a tiny, tiny percentage of the population. So Right. Clearly the people who are chosen are the elect.
Oh, so it's sort of like external validation almost for a child, isn't it?
But there's also the internal validation because the dragon loves you uncritically, adores you uncritically, is loyal only to you, can be controlled only by you.
Ah.
So it's just this whole immersive experience where internally and externally you're told and shown how special you are. You know, again, as a child, when you want nothing more than to figure out, you know, who you are, where your place in the world is, and what you're going to do in that wider world, the idea of it being handed to you in a nifty dragon-shaped package is enormously appealing. It's just this immersive, it's just this fantasy you can sink into. And then when I read the books more as an adult, I think to myself, it's an awful job because you're basically spending all day mucking out a dragon's stall. They don't keep these dragons around as expensive and showy pets. They're effectively a living air force that's supposed to go up and incinerate an airborne parasite. It's a dangerous job. It's, and given how primitive the society is, it's an uncomfortable job because you're up at tremendously high altitudes wearing basically a collection of furs. There's a high mortality risk and you can't have a normal family life because this bond with a dragon is so all consuming. You don't get married. And other people, if you choose to have children, which is rare for the female dragon riders in this universe, other people raise your children. If you're a male, you may see your child at dinner time with his or her foster parents.
Oh, wow.
Once you choose the dragon, you effectively dropped out of the rest of your life. As a child, this seemed like, I can have it all. I can have a career and someone takes care of all of the housework. And then, and this is where the cognitive disconnect came back in, when my daughter was born, and for the first 2 years of her life, she was a terrible sleeper. Like, she wouldn't sleep for more than 2 or 3 hours at a stretch, and I was up with her a lot in the middle of the night trying to get her back down. And as I would be rocking her, I'd be reading on my Kindle, and I downloaded all of the Dragon Rider books. And going back and rereading the references to parenthood when you are an adult and you are a parent, what struck me is how Anne McCaffrey is like, yeah, that is something other people do. You know, people who have interesting and fulfilling lives outsource their childcare to other folks. That is not a gratifying experience for them at all. And I was like, wow, what kind of message am I absorbing all those years? But it's a trend that comes up over and over again in her books, because the later books, the characters that she introduced to us in The Dragon Singer and in Dragon Quest, they have children, and those children have all been shuffled off screen to be raised by an army of foster parents.
Huh. Although, and again, I haven't read this, so I've only sort of read summaries, you know, as I was researching this, but it did strike me as I was reading the summaries of Dragon Song and Dragon Singer,
mm-hmm.
that there is a theme of, I'm a woman who wants to nurture and develop my talent, but I can't abandon these youngsters who need my help to grow up. In this case, the youngsters being
her tiny fire lizards, yeah.
Right, surrogates in the form of the fire lizards rather than actual children. But, I mean, that's a pretty strong metaphor, isn't it?
No, the relationship's not like that at all, because they are they are childish or they're dependent, rather, for a really brief time in the first book. And then after that, they're effectively her flying army of sidekicks that provide external validation. She teaches them to harmonize with her as she sings, so you have more proof that she's special. And they do errands for her. And I think their metaphorical function is to visibly mark her as different so that she looks as different externally as she feels internally.
And again, external validation, like, you know, this is something that was beyond my control, but it shows that I'm special.
Oh, yes, yes. These books are perfect. These books are perfectly primed for people ages 12 to 4, to 10 to 14. They really are. Even the ones aimed for adults come from a very adolescent place.
Well, it's... I mean, this is a very small sample size, but, yes. You know, the two people I know who love these books are mm-hmm. you and my partner, both of whom read them as preteen girls,
mm-hmm.
came to them first as preteen girls. So, yeah, that's interesting.
The thing I wonder, and I don't know your partner's age, I think it's necessary to understand where Anne McCaffrey may have fit in the wider fantasy and science fiction sphere at that time. And, I would be curious to find out what your partner thinks about Princess Leia, for example.
Oh, she has no interest in Star Wars whatsoever.
Oh, okay. I saw Star Wars at a very young age. I was 6, I think. And Princess Leia blew me away. And I was her for that. She's my I dressed up for her as Halloween for years. As a matter of fact, one of my Halloween costumes is my Twitter icon from when I was 6 or 7. And the reason Princess Leia connected with her on such a big level was because in the 1970s, you know, my only other exposure had been to Disney princesses who basically they're very passive. Their biggest values are that they are effectively very beautiful doormats. Things happen to them for the most part. And even the TV shows that were on at the time, you had Uhura on Star Trek, but she was just one of many. And she did the console while the men went off and had adventures. And the original Battlestar Galactica, where again, men got to be fighter pilots and women got to stay home and raise children in a spaceship. Or the anime series Battleship Yamamoto, which we also know Star Blazers, where you have the two principal female characters, like one of them is pining for the lead character and the other is a beautiful princess. So to see Princess Leia, who was actually, you know, heading up a political revolution and capable of operating a gun and mouthing off to Darth Vader, was revolutionary. And then when Anne McCaffrey is pumping out books where her heroines are effectively channeling a Princess Leia-like fierceness of intellect and determination and a complete lack of fear over whether or not they're liked, I think that was something that women in my cohort, when we were girls and when we were interested in nerdy science fiction things, we kind of latched onto that because there were comparatively few characters who were like that. And you look at fantasy and sci-fi now, and when we grew up and started writing that, we began writing more of those characters, and they're everywhere now. But they were really thin on the ground in the 70s and 80s, and you had, you know, Ursula K. Le Guin writing what she could, but for every one of those, you'd be picking up, say, the Chronicles of Narnia and then wondering what C.S. Lewis had against Susan. Or even, I can remember reading Little Women by Louisa May Alcott and feeling horribly betrayed by how that turned out. Or even Madeline L'Engle's A Wrinkle in Time, you get to the third one, A Swiftly Tilting Planet, and she sidelined the person who was the heroine for the first two books. And it was just so disappointing that these characters that you love turned out like that. And the Dragon Riders of Pern book, they don't. They continue having wonderful adventures, and they're not sidelined by domesticity in the slightest. And as a child, that was a message that I desperately needed to receive. As an adult, the reason I give it a really critical eye is because being able to balance your desire to be a partner and a parent against your desire to do the things that you're good at, that is something that people have to figure out. And it would have been nice to have somebody, you know, wrangling how to do that in literature. Maybe we're doing that now. Maybe that's where we are. Maybe that's where we are now in our evolution of society and personal development.
Maybe so, yeah. I mean, McCaffrey, I don't know much about her either, but I do know that I believe she wrote the first book before she had children. But then by the time she was writing the Dragon Singer, Mm-hmm. But she did have a couple of children.
and that's why all of the books are like, and then the children were bundled off to foster mothers where nobody judged the parents for that act at all. Because there seems to be...
more wish fulfillment.
Well, you know, I find it fascinating, and I haven't read anything about her at all. And I'm certainly not suggesting otherwise, but what I find fascinating is how most of her emphasis on parenting is, yes, this is something that happens to other people. And part of me wonders if this is her working out her own ambivalence about trying to parent while also building her writing career, or if this is her legitimizing the model that she used to balance her parenting with her writing career. I just find it very interesting that in her world, she very calmly and matter-of-factly says, well, you know, some people have children and then hand them off to other people to raise, and it's socially accepted because children are effectively communal.
Well, and let's not forget, it wasn't that long ago in our world that that actually was acceptable. You know, in the upper classes, you would quite happily have nannies and send the children off to private schools and all that. Mm-hmm. And in the working classes, you would have communal raising of children. While somebody was out, you know, working or doing something, the neighbors would look after the children. That was, even when I was growing mm-hmm. up, that was still something that regularly happened.
You're right. That intensive one-on-one parenting model is really comparatively new, and it's also become it's a much different class signifier, at least in the United States, than it used to be, because now it is a big class signifier for I don't have to work, and I can professionalize my parenting experience, and here I am doing it. There are people who've actually commodified their parenting via mommy blogs and turned it into a luxury experience.
Well, and the extreme desire to do it as well is it's a very 90s thing, really, isn't it?
It is, yes. 90s oddies.
Blame 30-something.
You know, you probably could. yeah, and what I also find funny is we've introduced my 4-year-old to Mary Poppins, and she is fascinated by the idea that the children only see their parents once before bed. You know, because that's very different from her experience where, you know, we spend a couple of hours with her around her preschool time every day. And then we're with her all, you know, for long stretches on the weekend too. But no, it's the Anne McCaffrey books, to bring it back. They are perfect for adolescents because they effectively sideline all of the boring domestic work. Any chores people do are chores for the greater good, such as, you know, taking care of a dragon or figuring out how to move a comet or whatever the later books are about. In almost every book, there is somebody who has to do the heavy internal work of differentiating themselves from their background or their upbringing, so they can really be themselves and follow their dreams. And you know, that goes in tandem with the work that children do to develop an identity of themselves about themselves, independent of their parents or their role in their family.
That's very true. Yeah.
So they're basically great. They're great books on how to be a teenager, even as an adult. and I loved the idea of being, you know, because again, 10, 11, 12, I love the idea of being able to ride a dragon and to fly and to be part of a subculture that was different from the rhythm and flow of society and yet had its own structure and ability to excel, which is a wonderful metaphor for the university experience when you think about it.
Yep. Well, and I think that's a large part of the attraction in the modern day of the Divergent books. I don't know if you've read those. But I'm sure that a lot of the attraction there for the young girls reading those is that the character mm-hmm. does, you know, of the societies available to her, she joins the one that is rebellious, that is most like a subculture that breaks the rules, that lives apart from all the others. I have no doubt that that is, you know, a large part of their attraction to, as I say, the army of young girls
yes.
that are reading those books.
Yes, I think you're right. Just like I think The Hunger Games by Suzanne Collins are in some way almost this, they're spiritually descended from The Dragon Riders of Pern. I would say maybe a second cousin in the sense that you have a heroine who is tough-minded and
doesn't care about her looks.
Yes, she's tough-minded, doesn't care about her looks. She's fiercely focused on ambition to the point of excluding social niceties. And What I find interesting is that in the Hunger Games books, she's acutely aware of how her own behavior and traits may handicap her in larger society, whereas in the Dragonflight books, the chief heroine, Lessa, is utterly and supremely unconcerned. in the parlance of the day, Lessa's doing Lessa. And, and the book starts out with her effectively lurking and hiding in the home that she was supposed to inherit and biding her time plotting her revenge. And over the course of the first few chapters, you find out that really she's a very patient, very vengeful person. And she's built her entire life around the idea that she is going to engineer the downfall of the person who killed her family, which she does like within three chapters. And this gives you a great, and this gives you a great idea of what you're dealing with. And then she spends her psychological development is when she turns from her original goal to thinking, okay, how can I actually save my planet, which is in danger from this airborne parasite and a lack of people and dragons. And so the book is about her development, her being able to, you know, be more than a bloody-minded revenge machine.
Right, from selfishness to selflessness, yeah.
But what's interesting is she really doesn't care that she's abrasive. She doesn't care that she's single-minded. She has no problem with who she is and no qualms about anything she does. And that is a really bracing and enlightening thing to read as a girl in the 1980s.
Isn't it ironic that these are exactly the same traits that young boys look for in male heroes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they're available. I mean, the heroine in the YA book is not nearly so intimidating or abrasive. And I wonder if it's the veil of artistic talent that gives her more latitude to be a sweeter person, you know, because she's... Mm. Whereas... Lessa just has to be fearsome. What I do find interesting is that in the earlier books, Lessa's traits of being very direct, not having a lot of patience for fools, her tendency to want to, does this need to be done? Well, then go do it. Stop dithering. Those are just seen as very matter of fact things that occasionally throw people off balance because they're not used to dealing with somebody who, you know, expects you to say how high when she says jump. And by the much later book, she's almost a caricature of her earlier self. And again, I wonder what this says about McCaffrey's changing regard for her world. And what this says about her own evolution as a person, where perhaps in the earlier book she was writing the kind of person she wanted to be or the kind of person she felt she was, and she wanted to defend this as a plausible model for being. And by the later books, you know, there's a little more opportunity to reflect, or she's trying to stretch her writing skills and say, all right, this is how other people might actually perceive her as opposed to how I perceived her in the first few books.
That would strike me as very plausible, yeah. So we've talked a lot about how they appeal to young girls, and a lot of that appeal is because of their sort of fantasy nature, as you say, the lovely artwork with the gossamer winged dragons.
Oh, God, so
and the
great.
The idea of, you know, sort of breaking the bonds of an archaic society.
Mm-hmm.
All of which is very centered around the sort of fantasy milieu. And I confess that's one of the reasons that I've never read these books, is because when I was young and I was devouring SF at a, you know, an insane rate, I did avoid these books because, and it's not that I didn't enjoy fantasy. I love fantasy. I read plenty of Tolkien and Moorcock and Fritz Lieber and all that stuff. But the Perm books did look like...
They're frankly, very girly.
Girls' books. They looked like girls' books, yeah. And then when I was old enough to reconsider and realize that that wasn't really the case, I had enough other stuff to read that I never got round to it. And as I say, and you know, I never have got round to it. But my point here is that I'm driving towards is they're not fantasy books. They are science fiction.
Yes.
And I understand you mentioned earlier about sort of backstopping some elements of this, but I wonder how much of that was present in the first couple of books, because the whole premise of the books is about the dragons being the only thing that can save the planet from this thread fall, this terrible burning stuff that falls from the sky every 250 years.
Mm-hmm.
The people live in caves underground to survive it. You know, it's bringing back the sort of last line of defense to save the planet, which is a very fantasy kind of idea. But then you discover that thread fall is has a scientific basis. It's because of the elliptical orbit of this planet. And, you know, it's all about planetary orbits and solar orbits and that sort of thing. And so, and that's very SF, obviously. And as I understand it, they even, the way that they save the world is by
pure science.
Going to this planet, and using like sort of...
They genetically engineer a virus to kill off the parasite.
Yeah.
In the earlier... Well, the introduction itself is actually fairly... It has deep, strong science fiction roots because she starts off by giving you the astronomical position of the planet. She explains that there's an object that was attracted into orbit that has the irregular 250-year orbit, and it's seeded with parasites. And this irregular orbit is what causes the thread fall. And... again, the reason Pern is Pern is because folks got there via spaceship. So,
and they, all this is explained right up front.
All of this is explained right up front.
Ah, I didn't realize that. I thought this was a revelation that came out during the book.
She starts off by saying, this is the planet, this is the situation. The colonists genetically engineered dragons, which is something that she points out really early on, like from the 60s on. It's the colonists created dragons. All of these people who are living on this planet know two things. They know that they came there from outer space, or their forebears did, and they know that dragons were created. They didn't evolve naturally. So those are two tenets of Pernia's culture and education right off the bat. And in the first book, she lays all this out, and then it effectively is a fantasy quest and coming of age with some time travel involved. And her time travel is fairly simple and fairly unsophisticated. And the premise is that if you just know when you're going back and you have a fixed point in time, boom, you can get there. It doesn't go into any sort of alternate timelines. It doesn't talk about what to do if you wanted to go forward in time. That's actually something that her son's tackled a few times in the books that he's written since her death. But as she progresses through her original adult trilogy, it does get a little more hard sci-fi because they start discovering some of the documentation that the original colonists left behind, where you find where somebody is mentioning mycorrhizae, which is fungus and how fungi grow and reproduce, and is meant to be a model for how thread works and reproduces on the land. And they have a lot of cues about astronomy. So the books turn more hard sci-fi over time, other than this really unfortunate foray into bioengineered dolphins, which is just insane, should never have been published. And you know, I read that and I was like, David Byrne did this better with the Uplift trilogy. But but yeah, they are, by the end of the series, it's essentially a science primer, because they get into, you know, here's how to manufacture scientific instruments, here's how to calculate orbits, here's how to calculate trajectories, here's how to move mass through space when there's no gravity, here's how to engineer viruses, here's how to engineer a plague, here's how to engineer inoculations. And this is all explained by an artificial intelligence, which is also explained in exhaustive detail through a few chapters. So over time, it's less gauzy dragons and ladies on dresses with things fluttering in the wind, and more people affecting a scientific revolution over the course of a generation. And to McCaffrey's credit, the last few books she wrote talk about the reverberations that this has over a quasi-feudal society. As an adult, the two things that do bother me about the Pern books are, one, there's never really an adequate explanation for how the society devolved from a scientifically sophisticated group of people who wanted to live simply and with as little technology as possible, but, you know, still some sort of baseline, how society devolved from that into this feudal system with oral learning. Because there's like a throwaway line in one of the early books that women don't read. And I was all, even as a child, like, wait, what? Why would you do that? You know, there's never been an adequate explanation for how that happens. And I think her son is trying to backfill it in now. And the second thing that bothers me, and this is tied into the gender relations as well, is I don't think her treatment of human sexuality is particularly useful or nuanced. And this actually comes back to impression. To explain to readers who haven't read these books, dragons come in two sexes, male and female. And her and McCaffrey's general rules were that if the dragon is male, only men can impress the dragon. If the dragon is female and gold, it is the gold female dragons, the reproductive dragons, for some reason, they're only impressed by women. When she first started writing the books, the green dragons, which were also female, were impressed by men. And it took me, oh God, I think I was finally like in high school and the penny dropped that these men are gay. No, and it was because another huge component of the adult books, and I honestly feel like this is a way to like spice things up and boost sales, is that when the dragons have mating flights, you know, the female dragons launch and the male dragons have to pursue them, and the most fit mate catches the dragon and proves the species, et cetera, et cetera. The premise is that the dragon's riders are so overcome with their dragon's lust that they can't help but consummate the mating flight on the ground. And this is actually a very, you know, eyebrow raising plot line in Dragonflight, which we can get to in a minute if you'd like. But what I remember reading the books as a child and thinking, well, if the green dragons go up, what are the men doing? And it took me literally like right. 6 or 7 years for the penny to drop. And I was, oh, that's why they're called women by people who don't like them. And over the course of the books, McCaffrey's gotten more nuanced, and a little bit more comfortable with saying, yes, you know, these green men who are green riders are homosexuals. And her son has even gone so far as to say women who are lesbians can impress blue dragons. And now I'm on the side eye because the green dragons and the blue dragons are supposedly like at the bottom of the dragon heap. And so, wait a minute, are you saying that the gender fluid dragons are somehow inferior to the bigger ones? It's you know,
slightly problematic. Yeah.
Yes, pairing the sex of the dragon with the sex of, with the sexuality of the writer, I think, was a mistake. And I can say that now from my comfortable 21st century perch. But, you know, it's something that I think readers today do find jarring and offensive, simply because this is the world that they're growing up in now. Whereas, you know, if you're growing up in the 70s and 80s, it's so coded, it takes you a while to figure out how she's dancing around the subject, even as she's throwing in the occasional salacious scene here and there.
Well, and there's also just notions of, as you say, context of the times and attitude towards sex and sexuality. It's like watching the Sean Connery James Bond movies,
mm-hmm.
now, you know, from a modern perspective. You watch them now and there are parts where I'm like watching through my fingers.
Yes.
Because, you know, because the way the women are treated in those movies is
appalling.
But at the time it was seen by the men, admittedly, you know, as just perfectly normal.
And that's actually comes up in Dragonflight too, because there is a big mating flight, of course, Les's dragon goes up. And the idea is that the first time Les's dragon flies near for her mating flight, it actually determines who's going to lead the Weir and the dragons from here on. And so it's got political stakes, and the right person, of course, the right person slash dragon combination wins. And there are a few uncomfortable passages. As a child, I even gave it the side eye. And as an adult, I'm like, okay, there's consent issues here. Where Les's partner in running the Weir wishes to continue having sex with her outside of mating flights. And the way the passages are written, it implies that it happens, it also implies that she doesn't like it. And even in the 1960s context, the passage is, unless the dragons were involved, he might as well call it rape. But you will note it also says nothing about, so he stopped. It doesn't say that at all. It just says he wishes she would get over her attitude.
Right.
And even, you know, even when I read the book the first time in the 80s, I'm like, wait, what? How? No, you know, I was, it, and there's no, there's, you know, you're,
there's no might as well about it, really, is there?
Yeah, no, and I was 11 and 12 and trying to bottom out how, I was trying to figure out how this was acceptable for the character, and I was trying to figure out why an author would do this. And, you know, now through the lens of adulthood, I'm like, well, she is addressing in her own oblique way the issue of what agency you do or don't have with a dragon. But it's still a really troublesome, you know, the notion that you could be in a coercive sexual relationship as a dragon rider is a really troubling one. And, you know, it gets addressed poorly in some of the later books, but it's an uncomfortable part of the world. And it's one that, you know, I think younger readers today are just going to be, wait, no, uh-uh. as they should be.
Absolutely, yeah. Okay, so we've talked about a few of the problematic issues. So let's close out by saying, despite those issues and, you know, not dismissing them, but being aware of them and putting them in context, what is it about them you think that would appeal to modern readers, people today who haven't read the books and might want to, you know, go and find them now after listening to this? How would you How would you sell them on these books?
It is such skilled and immersive world building. She does everything from explain the ecosystem of the different species, and you really get a vivid sense of the world, the bugs that are crawling in there. And because McCaffrey was musical herself, she took great care to embroider the arts and crafts culture. So you have a sense of Pernie's aesthetic. You have a sense of how they entertain themselves. She embroiders the social gatherings in the political world and the day-to-day details of dragon riding. So if you are looking for a set of books that you can just kind of dive in and lose yourself in a whole other world, you know, the stories themselves are fairly standard man versus themselves, man versus their nature. But the experience of these stories taking place in a world with, you know, big telepathic dragons and seas that are teeming with bioengineered dolphins and lush plants in the south and complex cave systems turned cities in the north. For pure escapism, it hits all the buttons. They're not challenging reads. They're entertaining. It's fun to watch how she's constructed her world. It's fun to pick up on the customs that she's decided do and don't fit. And it's, you know, and I think there is actually a place in people's reading repertoire for books that are entertaining without being entertaining and absorbing without being challenging, the kind of thing that you can happily read 5 or 6 chapters before going to bed at night, and you're not going to want to stay up until 3 a.m. finishing the book, but you're going to look forward to reading a few more chapters every night because that's the way it progresses. I think there's a real need for that, or there's a need for a book you can read on an airplane where you enjoy the experience. It allows you to forget that you're in a metal tube with recirculated air for a few hours. And when you're done, you can leave the book.
Funnily enough, that's actually how I think of most of Michael Moorcock's fantasies. You know, the Elric books, the Hawkmoon yes. books, the Corran books. I love them. I really do love those books. But that's exactly how I think of them, as competent, well-told stories. They're not earth-shattering. They're not going to challenge your perceptions, at least not as a modern reader. Mm-hmm. But you look forward to reading them and they're entertaining, yeah.
Yes, I especially as I get older, I think I envy much younger readers because I have difficulty getting immersed in a new world or even in a new book the same way that I was able to as a child right, yeah. and through my teens and through my 20s. But as I get older, I have started tidily sorting my books into unchallenging reads that I need so I can simply relax and unwind and let my brain wander and noodle along versus things I want to read because I'm burning to read them or things that I know are going to be really absorbing and keep me up all night. For example, I love William Gibson's books. I always feel like I have to clear my schedule for those books because once I start reading them, I can't put them down. And, I read one recently for The Incomparable, and it was basically, you know, my face in the Kindle and a hand warding off everybody around me for 2 days.
The last Gibson book I read, I actually took with me when we visited family over Christmas and New Year. And because I knew that while I was there, I would be doing nothing else other than obviously, you know, just sort of socializing with family. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was my, okay, I'm going to take a Gibson book because I know I can read it undistracted by anything else.
Yes, this is why I take Neil Stephenson on airplanes, is because if I'm flying across the continent and I have 6 hours and I have to also kill time in an airport thanks to our ridiculous security, I want something. I'm a fairly quick reader, so I want something big and meaty that I can...
That will last.
Yes. Yeah, this is how I ended up reading Stephen King's Doorstoppers, is I was on an emergency flight to Boston and desperately needed something in those and ran to the bookstore and grabbed the biggest book I could. But you know, the Pern books are great airplane books. If you're looking for something that will not haunt you after the flight, you know, they're great bedtime reading books. They're great immersive. You know, I want a world that is not my own, that is just different enough to pique my interest, but not so different that it's going to make me think troubling thoughts about gender relations or family structure or division of labor or economics, or, you know, because there are also alternate. One of my favorite science fiction authors as an adult is Sherry Tepper, but all of her books are deeply disturbing on some level. and so, you know, when you want a book that's not going to be particularly challenging, you know, McCaffrey is your lady.
And on that note, let's draw this to a close. Lisa, where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
I'm on Twitter. My handle is Elschmeiser, and that's spelled L-S-C-H-M-E-I-S-E-R. S-E-R. I can also be found on The Incomparable on a fairly regular basis on a few of the different podcasts. And if you look at my Twitter bio, you can also get a link to my newsletter, So What? Who Cares?, where I do a rundown of stories that are developing in the world and explain So What?, which is why it's a big story and why it's a big deal, and Who Cares?, which tells you who the stakeholders are. And each issue of So What? Who Cares? Also includes a little pop culture recommendation and analysis for you.
Excellent. Lisa Schmeiser, thank you very much.
Thank you. This was great. I would happily come on this again if given the opportunity.
I will hold you to that.
Excellent.
You've been listening to Unjustly Maligned, episode 14, with Anthony Johnston and Lisa Schmeiser. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. If you're enjoying the show, please do consider taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes. It really helps. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
But I do actually have, like, the Dragon Lover's Guide to Burn.
Oh, wow. Wow, is this some unofficial companion book or something?
It's an official companion book.
It's official.
Jody Lynn Nye worked a lot with Anne McCaffrey, and Michael Whalen did many of the illustrations for the official Dragon Lover's Guide to Pern.
Oh wow!
And there are also a series of Choose Your Own Adventure books that were written in conjunction by Jody Lynn Nye, which focus on like third tier characters, and I have a few of those too.
Oh wow!
And what I love about those books is the Pern depicted there is a lot more difficult to live in and a little bit grittier, and it shows some of the realities when you aren't an A-lister on the planet. Like, and you know, as an adult, I love it. And but I can remember, you know, hunting these books down and reading them as a 13-year-old or 14-year-old and just being, no, why are you interrupting my fantasy like this?
If I'd known that, I don't believe those were ever published over here. Yeah. If I'd seen game books, I would have been well into it. I probably would have ended up reading the books because I spent my entire teenage years and beyond playing fighting fantasy books, playing Dungeons and Dragons constantly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's a shame that I never saw those over here.
They weren't very widely published or disseminated. I got them, I lived in a small military town in Virginia, and so when I got a chance to go to bigger cities, I always begged my parents to take me to bookstores so that I could find books that I wasn't able to get at the library or through you know, our we had a local independent bookstore, and she would let me peruse the catalog and put in special orders. But, you know, there are still books that you can't get that way, and I could get them in big cities, and that's how I managed to get a hold of those books.
Yeah, I haunted my local library for much the same thing. Yeah.
No, I don't think kids today. I don't get off my lawn. Now, McCaffrey's relationship with fanfic was complicated because early on she's like, please don't write it. Please. You know, I put a lot of time and effort into thinking about this place, and I have very specific reasons for why I do what I do, you know, which may or may not be true. But she originally frowned on it, and then toward the end of her life, she's like, okay, fine. If you have to write it, write it. Just here are the list of characters who are off limits to you. Please don't write about the characters I like the best. And
That's an interesting way of handling it, yeah.
What's striking is the majority of the stories and the fan art generated are basically about the peasantry of Pern, or they're about people, you know, the elites like the dragon riders who lived in periods that Anne McCaffrey hasn't written about. So, you know, they were very good about reinforcing and self-policing the requests that Anne McCaffrey had, which I also found interesting because I've seen other communities where the fans, you know, will basically turn around and shout at the creator, you can't tell me what to do with your creations. So those were the first style was the first time the Elric covers I saw were done in that style too. Cause, you know,
right.
This is back when Bantam and other publishers were refreshing their covers about every 5 years to try to catch a new generation of readers. But,
well, and it worked. Mm-hmm. Those, you know, I remember because I'm a little of a completist myself. And I remember being terribly excited at the notion that I could buy an entire set of Moorcock Eternal Champion books with the same trade dress and the same cover artist on all of them. And it's ridiculous. I already owned half of them.
Yes. Oh, no.
As a teenager, I was terribly excited that I could buy, finally, an entire library of them that would all have matching covers and spines.
Oh, yes, because it's well, there's a certain aesthetic pleasure in having that sort of, having that in your library.
There is.
Absolutely sympathize with that.
The irony is that I lost them all.
Oh, no.
I'm now trying to think who would be more offended by my Moorcock McCaffrey comparison.